On Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
The number of missing and murdered young women and girls in the Galveston, Texas area throughout the 1970s, 80s, and into the 90s is staggering. Though some of the crimes have been solved since, many remain mysteries to this day, even after the formation of a specialized task force made up of local law enforcement and FBI agents, with its own unique database built to address the problems specifically. The Texas killing fields, perhaps, stretch as far beyond where it is often considered to be centralized, in the Calder oil field in League City. Often, folks theorize that these slayings and disappearances can be attributed to one, two, or even three killers. It is, perhaps, more difficult to fathom that several serial killers were on the loose in such a concentrated area, but it is, surely, more likely. Many of the missing and murdered in the area received little press and, seemingly, little effort from law enforcement. The Jane Does found certainly received little to no attention, and some disappearances, such as those of Sandra K. Ramber and Michelle Doherty Thomas in 1983 and 1985 respectively, got the same treatment. But the press was enamored with two area disappearances in particular, the 1986 abduction of Shelley Sykes, who police described as, quote, everybody's daughter, and the 1988 abduction of Suzanne Renee Richardson, who was dubbed by law enforcement the All-American Girl. Suzanne Renee Richardson, who was known to most by her middle name, was born in Williamson County, Texas on December 8, 1965. She was the firstborn child of Catherine Richardson, a branch manager at Capital City Savings in Killeen, and Clyde Richardson, who worked for an engineering firm. 3 years after she was born, Renee's brother, Sean, was welcomed into the family, and 3 years after that, a sister, Laura. Renee's outgoing personality rendered her well-liked by fellow students through her elementary, junior high, and high school years. According to her father, Clyde, Renee was bubbly, enthusiastic, and full of school spirit, a natural as a cheerleader in high school. She kept her grades up too, landing herself a membership in the National Honor Society. After high school graduation, Renee enrolled at Texas A&M University in Galveston, where she spent her freshman and sophomore years. The Galveston campus was small, but it was close to the beach, so naturally it consisted mainly of students who sought careers in maritime industries and marine biology. Renee's enthusiasm followed her to college, and she enjoyed participating in school activities and Aggie traditions. Renee was a proud Aggie, which is the nickname given A&M students that came from the word agriculture, represented by the letter A in the school's name, and spent her junior year studying at Texas A&M's main campus in College Station before returning to A&M Galveston to complete her senior year, but not before striking up a romance with a fellow student. Her school spirit was still strong, and she looked forward to participating in one of Texas A&M's longest-standing traditions, the Elephant Walk. The tradition goes way back, when the class of 1926 took a final walk around the school's campus, reminiscing about their time there, strolling single file, and each with their hand resting on the shoulder of the classmate in front of them. A witness observed the student's bittersweet stroll, which was both celebratory and somber, and remarked that they, quote, looked like elephants about to die. The act was thus named the Elephant Walk and began being practiced every year prior to the last home Aggie football game of the season. fellow Aggies who knew Renee were easily charmed by her. She was a pleasure, they said, to be around. One classmate commented that she was an amazing person who had immense passion and joy for life. "We Aggies stick together," Student Services Vice President Bill Hearn said. "On this campus, almost everyone knows everyone else. I considered her a friend of mine and a bright, talented, had everything going for her type of kid." In September of 1988, Renee's brother Sean entered A&M Galveston as a freshman, and the two decided they'd room together, renting an apartment off campus in a restored early 20th century house. To help pay for school, Renee took a part-time job as a night shift desk clerk at the Casa Del Mar condominium and hotel complex on Seawall Boulevard, just off the shore of Galveston Bay. The Casa Del Mar seemed like a good gig. It was a nice place, and the fully furnished condos allowed residents and guests a direct view of the ocean. The overnight shift was ideal for an always studying college senior, too, since it was quiet, most of the Casa Del Mar's traffic taking place in the daytime hours. It was a seemingly ideal job to take her through her senior year, sure, but Renee Richardson had her sights set on much bigger things. She was majoring in maritime administration, with her short-term vision locked on seaport management, and planned to enter law school to study maritime law, a specific body of the law that concerns private maritime disputes, from small domestic issues to large international ones. Renee was taking on a lot, but if anyone could handle it, it was her.
"She's about the only person I know who could carry a full course load, work all night, and come to school with a smile on her face," a classmate remarked.
On Thursday, October 6th, 1988, Renee Richardson began her shift at the Casa Del Mar at her regular time, 11 p.m. Presumably, Renee's shift began as typical and uneventful as any of her others. At 6 a.m. the following morning, Friday, October 7th, a private security guard for the condo hotel complex punched out from his shift and, he'd later tell police, looked over and saw Renee sitting at the lobby's desk. "It was an hour before her shift was up, and nothing was out of the ordinary," he said. Minutes later, a Casa Del Mar employee, sleeping in a room just above the lobby, heard a woman scream, followed by the sound of a slamming car door. Another scream let out, the employee said, this time followed by the screeching tires of a vehicle speeding off, presumably from the parking lot just below. At 6:18 a.m., a couple entered the lobby of the Casa Del Mar to check out, but no one was at the front desk. They laid the key to their room on the counter and left. The morning clerk arrived in the lobby to relieve Renee at 6:45 a.m. and found that her fellow employee wasn't at her station. Renee's purse, school books, and keys were still there, however, as was the car she'd borrowed to get to work in the parking lot outside. The morning shift employee called police. When Galveston police arrived, responding officers began looking for signs that a struggle had occurred, but could find none. Later that morning, a Casa Del Mar maintenance worker found one of Renee's tan leather shoes in the parking lot. Two guests there also reported hearing screams that morning, one of which presumably thought it was coming from the hallway or another room, since they reported leaving their room upon hearing the sounds to try and discern where they originated. When investigators later arrived, they found scuff marks on the door that leads to the area behind the front desk, as well as on the desk where Renee sat. A Be on the Lookout alert was issued for Renee Richardson, who was considered last seen at 6 a.m. She was described as standing 5 feet 8 inches tall, weighing 140 pounds. Renee had shoulder-length brownish-blonde hair and blue eyes. She wore contacts and had a small scar above her right eyelid. When she disappeared, she was wearing a dark gray long-sleeve blouse and a denim skirt. though the search for Renee Richardson would be immense and intensive, mostly due to the efforts of the Richardson family, the 22-year-old college senior was never seen again. On the afternoon of Friday, October 7, 1988, Clyde and Catherine Richardson, along with other family members, arrived in Galveston from their home in Florence, Texas, after receiving word that their daughter, Renee, had vanished from her place of employment early that morning. Galveston police began distributing photographs of Renee Richardson to the press. Renee's brother, Sean, who she shared a Galveston apartment with, told the police he could think of no reason his sister would leave work without notice. She was responsible, and it just wasn't like her. Police also spoke with Renee's boyfriend, who, presumably, was in College Station at the time, since he was enrolled at Texas A&M there, but he couldn't help either. All 276 rooms of the Casa Del Mar condo hotel where Renee worked were searched, but there were no signs of her. Captain of the Galveston Police, Ernest Galvin, made it clear right off the bat that they were treating Renee's disappearance as the result of foul play. It was obvious to law enforcement that the 22-year-old had been abducted. Still, by Monday, October 10th, authorities were at a standstill as far as leads. Police had been scrambling over the weekend to interview Renee's friends and classmates, and sightings of the young woman called into the police department had to be checked out. Meanwhile, around 40 Texas Department of Corrections officers and mounted police gathered to form a search party. A foot search was conducted the following week at a Texas state park in Galveston, but it produced nothing, and the tip that led to the search was considered a prank by police. Anonymous tipsters, it seemed, were calling in by the droves, but none were leading police any closer to finding Renee's whereabouts. The security guard who'd last seen Renee Richardson as he left his shift was polygraphed, as was a woman who'd seen Renee in the office early on the morning she vanished, but they both passed the examinations without issue. By Wednesday, October 12, 1988, Galveston residents and fellow A&M students had pulled together a $15,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and indictment of Renee's abductor or abductors. $5,000 of the reward money was put up by Renee's employer, the Casa Del Mar Condo Hotel, who said they'd do whatever it takes to get the young woman back. She was an excellent employee, they pointed out. But even more importantly, they said, Renee was kind, considerate, and a, quote, achiever in life. At this point, the FBI became involved, and their agents, along with local police, Galveston County Sheriff's Department deputies, and the district attorney, formed a task force to work on Renee's case. The Casa Del Mar lobby where Renee worked was difficult to see from the road. Texas A&M students came up with an idea concerning this fact, one that was quite clever. At 5 a.m. on Friday, October 15, 1988, exactly a week after Renee disappeared, they gathered at the corner of Seawall Boulevard and 61st Street, where the Casa Del Mar was located, to hand out missing flyers featuring Renee's photograph and description.
It's not really easy to see from the roadway down to where the office is located,
Renee's fellow student, Brian Patton, said.
The whole idea of going out there at that time was to meet somebody who follows that route regularly, a newspaper deliverer or a truck driver, somebody who might have seen something.
Their efforts produced little to no significant information, but it wasn't for the lack of investigative ingenuity. The students, too, weren't giving up and began planning their next step, which was a billboard they'd relocate several times for maximum exposure. Almost a month after the disappearance of Renee Richardson, a disturbing rumor of unknown origin began circulating through Galveston. A mutilated body had been found on Wednesday, November 2, 1988, so the rumor went, half of the body in Santa Fe, and the other half in Texas City. Word had it that the mutilated body matched Renee's description. Police, however, said there was no such body found, and since a similar discovery was never reported in the news, the rumor seemed to have come out of the clear blue sky. Not long after Renee's disappearance, Clyde and Catherine Richardson hired private eye Willie Payne to investigate their daughter's case.
"I want this case bad," the private investigator told the press. "There's never really been a trail to follow. The hardest murder to solve is when the murderer doesn't know the victim."
Payne immediately began asking for tipsters to call him, anonymously and collect, with information pertaining to Renee's disappearance. On December 5, 1988, six individuals connected to the case, or simply connected to Renee, received anonymous phone calls. According to PI Willie Payne, the caller claimed to have been involved with the abduction and murder of Renee. The caller sobbed as he gave his admissions and claimed that he was with two men who kidnapped, killed, and buried the young woman at a location around 15 to 20 miles west of Hitchcock, Texas. The calls apparently led to nothing substantial. If they were made by someone involved, police theorized the calls were possibly made to throw off the investigation. On December 9th, Galveston Police Captain Ernest Galvin told a reporter for the Daily News that the task force had given 10 polygraph examinations, searched six separate areas by foot, plane, and divers, and even checked out dozens of leads called in by self-professed psychics. A composite sketch from a witness description was made, though this wouldn't become known to the public until 1997, and it's unclear when exactly it was produced. Not only that, when the sketch was eventually released, when, how, and where the individual portrayed by the drawing fit into Renee Richardson's disappearance isn't explained at all. As the new year came, and after Renee had been missing for 3 months, law enforcement wasn't any closer to finding answers. On January 8, 1989, Detective Harry Milo, who was charged with investigating Renee's case on a full-time basis, basically echoed what his chief said a month before, but elaborated some on where divers had searched, giving that location as, quote, off Pelican Island in Galveston Bay. Detective Milo stressed the importance of tips from the public, saying that the department still needs their help and that information the public provides will probably be what solves the case. Detective Milo vented to the press,
"It's frustrating, very frustrating, but you just wait. All we know really is the probability that she's been abducted. She didn't have the type of personality to just walk off," he said, ignoring, maybe intentionally, the fact that actual physical clues also strongly suggested such.
He hoped that Renee's face, which could be seen all over Galveston Island on missing persons flyers, would strike a chord with her abductor and likely slayer. Guilt, he hoped, would play a role, perhaps relying on a false optimism that presumed the person responsible for Renee's fate could feel it all.
"You're dealing with a human being," Detective Milo said. "You have to play on that person's sympathy and pray there's sympathy to play on."
It wasn't for Galveston PD's lack of trying that Renee Richardson's case was going nowhere. They were all over it, as were the press, much more so than neighboring jurisdictions who oversaw other missing persons cases, such as the 1983 disappearance of Sandra K. Ramber and the 1985 disappearance of Michelle Doherty Thomas, both in Santa Fe. The Richardson family and Texas A&M students deserve most of the credit for keeping Renee's case in the media. Aggies and friends of Renee continually organized and participated in news-generating events to keep her name out there, such as a tree-planting event outside the Northern Student Center on campus. Clyde and Catherine Richardson, Renee's parents, moved from Florence to be close to the efforts, most often driving the efforts, in fact, to find out what happened to their daughter. billboards continued to promote Renee's missing persons flyer, and cable networks like CNN, ESPN, and MTV gave cut-rate prices for commercial spots featuring Renee. Texas truck drivers, too, adorned their rigs with Help Find Renee posters. In 1989, the television program Missing Reward, hosted by Stacy Keach, best known for his role as Mickey Spillane's hard-boiled detective Mike Hammer on the TV show of the same name, ran Renee's case. In the show's reenactment of the abduction, based perhaps on a police theory, a man walked into the Casa Del Mar lobby, pretending to need to use the telephone, and when her guard was down, entered the door that led behind the lobby counter, overcame Renee, and took her. No substantial information was obtained from the television show airing. Galveston police, from the outside looking in, appeared to have no idea what happened to 22-year-old Renee Richardson, but it would later become perfectly clear that in actuality, they had at least three suspects in her abduction and likely slaying. By the early 1990s, the Galveston Police Department had identified three men as suspects in the October 7, 1988 abduction and likely murder of Renee Richardson. Renee's father, Clyde Richardson, told the Galveston Daily News that police shared the men's names with him as well as how they came on law enforcement's radar. Some individuals authorities interviewed, Clyde said, had either seen evidence or heard details of his daughter's kidnapping and slaying. Gabriel Escueda Soto, who was 26 years old when Renee disappeared, was eventually identified as one of the suspects. Though it's reported in some places that Soto was arrested for attempting to run over a potential witness who placed him speaking with Renee the night she was last seen, there is no such infraction on the man's record. Either charges for the incident were dropped, or it didn't happen. Soto was, however, charged and convicted of voluntary manslaughter just a few years before. In the early morning hours of February 17, 1985, outside a Galveston nightclub, gunfire erupted. A man leaving the club, George Cahey III, was hit once below his left armpit. Cahey was later found dead, laying face down in the backyard of a nearby home, presumably having bled to death from his wound as he attempted to flee. Witnesses identified Gabriel Soto's white Chevy Monte Carlo as the getaway vehicle, and a .38 caliber snub-nose handgun used in the crime was recovered by police in Offat's Bayou near a public boat ramp. It was linked to Soto. Few other details of the murder of Cahey can be found, but it is known that the altercation was the result of a dispute between the man and other members of Soto's family. Gabriel Escueda Soto received a sentence of 10 years probation for the shooting death of George Cahey III. In late July of 2002, Soto died of a drug overdose. One other suspect, whose name isn't publicly known, is also said to have died of an overdose. Some sources report that in May of 2001, police came across circumstantial evidence connecting two cousins to the abduction of Renee Richardson. They denied involvement and, apparently, law enforcement's evidence wasn't enough to tie them to the crime. Over the years, several digs were performed, but attempts to locate Renee's body, usually as the result of a tip called in, always fell flat. An anonymous caller to Austin's Crime Stoppers hotline, who claimed to have been involved in the abduction, led police just outside of Hitchcock to some isolated oil fields in January of 1989. Though jail trustees dug with shovels for an entire day while authorities carefully inspected the area, the searches there were fruitless. Private investigator Willie Payne continued to work the case too, and in May of 1990, he sought out the help of a man who utilized specific technologies to search for magnetic anomalies in the ground. though finding a naked human body by such a technique is virtually impossible, since a nude human has basically no associated magnetic quality. These techniques can be used to find buried bodies that are adorned with jewelry or metal shirt and pant buttons, for example. Payne flew this individual from his home in Washington, D.C. to Texas and brought him to an oil field located near the intersection of Farm to Market Road 2004 and Country Road 208, just west of Hitchcock and south of Danbury. The location Payne wished to have surveyed was based on a telephone tip he'd received. The caller, according to Payne, told him that he and two others had observed Renee working alone at the Casa Del Mar lobby, entered, forcefully abducted her, and threw her in the back of either a panel truck or a van. The men were oil field workers, the caller said, who were working in Galveston's Pelican Island at the time and were familiar with the Hitchcock oil fields since they'd worked those areas before. She was raped and then killed by these men, the caller told Payne, wrapped in a plastic tarp and buried using mechanical equipment somewhere near the location Payne sought to have looked at, far enough out to be hidden from passers-by on the nearby road. The description of the burial site that the caller gave was, reportedly, specific. The individual who Private Eye Payne had flown out spent 2 days surveying the area and located and marked 7 spots where his equipment detected magnetic anomalies in the earth. It is unknown if the areas marked were ever excavated, and if it wasn't done quickly, there is a definite possibility that the cattle that grazed at the field destroyed the markers. In December of 1989, a few months before these searches, private investigator Willie Payne led another search. He'd already had his eye on a property in Lamarck, Texas, since a man he'd considered a suspect was once a resident of this house, and when he received an anonymous call, it only strengthened this notion. The caller told Payne that they believed Renee Richardson could be buried there in the backyard of the house. According to the caller, just before the suspect moved out of the house, in either October or November of 1988, an area of the ground in the backyard was freshly disturbed. When Payne got permission from the property's owner to inspect it, he found an area of earth about 6 feet long and 3 feet wide where the ground was depressed. It was possible, Payne thought, that someone had dug there a year prior. After only 45 minutes of digging, though, it became clear that it would have been impossible to bury a body in the spot, since the many tree roots there made it impossible to dig far enough into the ground to place a body. Another dig the following year also took place in Lamarck, after police received a tip from a Texas City woman in October of 1990. She led police to a wooded area near a dry creek bed, not far from Interstate 45. Authorities excavated several areas, but again, there was nothing there. 10 years after Renee Richardson disappeared, another search for her remains took place in Brazoria County, just outside the Galveston County line. This search, which was the result of an anonymous tip, law enforcement later said, was the most promising lead they'd come across since the beginning. The caller told police that Renee's body was placed in Cloud Bayou, and Galveston City police divers uncovered, quote, a group of bone fragments in a stream there as they sifted through the silt and sludge. Police felt like they finally had answers to the mystery, but since no remains ever found have been positively identified as belonging to Renee Richardson, it was false hope. In July of 2004, a woman who came forward with information again raised the hopes of law enforcement and the Richardson family. Much like tipsters who'd come before, this informant was specific about her so-called knowledge concerning Renee's case. The woman told police that in 1992, her then-boyfriend and another man dug up Renee's remains from under a Galveston home and transported them to another location in an old bathtub. According to the woman, the men then crushed up Renee's bones and distributed them at an undisclosed location. Clyde and Catherine Richardson, Renee's parents, wasted no time submitting their DNA to police so that if any remains were found, they could be compared. Clyde spoke with a new witness who, according to the father, gave information that could not be gleaned from simply reading news reports of the case. She said on the night the men relocated the remains, she overheard them recount Renee's abduction and slaying in, quote, graphic detail. The woman's ex-boyfriend and the other man had long been suspects in Renee's disappearance. One of them, presumably, was Gabriel Escueda Soto. When the Galveston police were finally able to excavate under the central Galveston home, where the woman said Renee was dug up to be relocated, they found over 100 pieces of bone and bone fragment, and authorities who commented on the find felt certain they were human. After a forensic anthropologist examined them, however, the bones turned out to be those of an animal, not human at all, and hope for resolution was once again crushed. The Galveston police, of course, are all but certain that Renee Richardson's disappearance was the result of foul play. Many theorize her abduction and likely murder to be connected to more than 20 other murders and disappearances in the Galveston area, some even theorizing a connection to the Texas killing fields. A task force to investigate and attempt to connect or rule out connections was formed and comprised of officers from both local law enforcement and the FBI. The task force was called HALT, an acronym for Homicide Abduction Liaison Team, and consists of a separate and unique database that can compare similarities and identify the possible activities of a serial killer, or perhaps multiple serial killers. Though Galveston police and the Galveston County District Attorney continued to insist that they didn't have enough evidence against their suspects to warrant an attempt at indictment, Clyde Richardson believes that an attempt at an indictment against at least one of the individuals might have opened the floodgates of valuable information. Clyde and Catherine, who stayed in Galveston for 9 months after Renee disappeared to remain an active part of her case, were forever changed, forever scarred.
"We completely reworked our whole direction in life," Clyde said. "It made all of us realize that you have to live life one day at a time because it can be taken away from you suddenly."
Without them, their daughter's case would have likely received substantially less coverage in the media. Renee's friends and classmates, too, played an important role in that, and Clyde once commented on his surprise that his daughter had touched so many lives.
"People called us for years after she disappeared, people we didn't even know. They were people she had met at school and some she only knew briefly. Just the fact that people finding out about it so far down the line would do so much research to find out how to get in touch with us made us proud to know she had touched that many lives."
Amazingly and admirably, Clyde Richardson showed compassion for the person or persons responsible.
"Originally, I wanted to see whoever took her fry, and I guess I still do. But I also know whoever it is has probably suffered too. I don't think you can keep stuff like this inside you for this long without going crazy. Whoever this person is, they're going to have to reconcile with their family and with God, and now wouldn't be a bad time for it. They've had to live with it for years, like we have, and I think they'd be more at peace with themselves if something came to the surface."
If you have any information about the disappearance of Suzanne Renee Richardson, please help provide her family with answers by calling the Texas Department of Public Safety at 800-346-3243. If you haven't already, I'd like to suggest y'all check out our episode on the abduction of Shelley Sykes and our last episode on the disappearances of Sandra K. Ramber and Michelle Doherty Thomas, as they are all connected, if only by geography and period. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and $2.50 a month gives you access to Patreon-exclusive episodes that mostly cover solved crimes and concentrate on the bad actors who perpetrated them. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. It means the world to Erica and I. The Galveston Daily News, the El Paso Times, and the Houston Chronicle were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.